Engel, Oladamare, Jenyami, Olarun, God, Jehovah, Allah, Amun-Ra, the many names for the original ancestor, the ancestor who sees all and knows all, the creator of the heavens and the earth. We do not pour libation to you, but this morning we come pouring libation in memory and honor of our ancestors and asking them to intercede with you on our behalf. We know that our ancestors, being in the spirit world, are closer to you, and there's a greater opportunity that our request will be granted. We ask this morning that you grant the listeners the willingness to open their hearts and their minds to the information that's going to be shared, such that they will hear the truth and then be able to act on the truth. Ancestors, come and get your drink. We say libation. To our ancestors from Mother Africa, the ancestors who were the beginning of the human family that we now have, no matter what your ethnic or cultural background is, the beginning of human life as we know it was on the African continent. Every person on the face of the earth has as their original ancestor an African. We ask those Africans who were the first to conceive of a family, the first to plant a seed, the first to till the land, the first to domesticate animals, the first to navigate the mighty Nile River to Egypt, the first to build a skyscraper, the first to do surgeries, the first to explore the wonders of the galaxy, and as importantly, the first to conceive of the belief in one God. We ask those ancestors to come and be with us today to bring their wisdom, their hard work, their ingenuity to all that we do. Ancestors, come and get your drink. We say libation. To our ancestors who were murdered, displaced, diminished during our great Holocaust, our great Niafa, we do not forget you. We remember your unwilling sacrifice as your bodies are lined the Sahara and the Atlantic Ocean. We remember you and we honor you and we ask that you come and be with us today. Ancestors, come and get your drink. We say libation. We ask our ancestors who gave us the great document, the Ma'at, to come be with us, bring your additional sense of honor and integrity as embodied by Ma'at to our discussions and our listings this morning. Ancestors, come and get your drink. We say libation. To those ancestors from the Caribbean islands, from Brazil, from the southern parts of these United States, who through your unpaid labor laid the groundwork for the civilizations that are enjoyed by billions of people around the world. To those ancestors, we say we do not forget you. We remember your sacrifice, your hard work. And we ask that you come and be with us today to inspire us to also do the work required to correct a world that has gone mad. Ancestors, come and get your drink. We say libation. And to those ancestors who are yet to be born, those ancestors for whom we do good work, those ancestors to whom we pledge to honorably do righteous work all the time for ourselves, for our family, for our communities, so we can be correct to be able to benefit from the largesse that the Creator has provided for all of us. Ancestors, we pledge ourselves to continue to do work such that when you return, this place will be a better earth. Ancestors, come and get your drink. We say libation. And finally, we'd like to ask you in our audience to think of one of your ancestors, someone who you would like to be with us this morning. On the count of three, ask that ancestor to come and be with us. One, two, three. Ancestors, come and get your drink. We said libation, libation, libation. It is good.
Still up here.
That people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
A poem for Jose Campos Torres. I had said I wasn't going to write no more poems like this. I had confessed to myself all along, tracer of life, poetry, trends, that awareness, consciousness, poems that screamed of pain and the origins of pain and death had blanketed my tablets, and therefore my friends, brothers, sisters, in-laws, outlaws, and besides, they already knew. But Brother Torres, common ancient bloodline Brother Torres, is dead. I had said I wasn't going to write no more poems like this. I had said I wasn't going to write no more words down about people kicking us when we're down, about racist dogs that attack us and drive us down, drag us down and beat us down. But the dogs are in the street. The dogs are alive, and the terror in our hearts has scarcely diminished. It has scarcely brought us the comfort we suspected. The recognition of our terror and the screaming release of that recognition has not removed the certainty of that knowledge. How could it? Dogs, rabid, foaming with the energy of their brutish ignorance, stride the city streets like robot gunslingers and spread death as night lamps flash crude reflections from gun butts and police shields. I had said I wasn't going to write no more poems like this. but the battlefield has oozed away from the stilted debates of semantics, beyond the questionable flexibility of primal screaming. The reality of our city, jungle streets and their gestapos has become an attack on home, life, family, philosophy, total. It is beyond a question of the advantages of didactic niggerisms. The motherfucking dogs are in the street. In Houston, maybe someone said Mexicans were the new niggas. In L.A., maybe someone said Chicanos were the new niggas. In Frisco, maybe someone said Orientals were the new niggas. Maybe in Philadelphia and North Carolina, they decided they didn't need no new niggas. I had said I wasn't gonna write no more poems like this, but the dogs are in the street. It's a turnaround world where things are all too quickly turned around. It was turned around so that right looked wrong. It was turned around so that up looked down. It was turned around so that those who marched in the street with Bibles and signs of peace became enemies of the state and risk to national security, so that those who questioned the operations of those in authority on the principles of justice, liberty, and equality became the vanguard of a communist attack. It became so you couldn't call a spade a motherfucking spade. Brother Torres is dead. The Wilmington 10 are still incarcerated. Ed Davis, Ronald Reagan, James Hunt, and Frank Rizzo are still alive, and the dogs are in the motherfucking street. I had said I wasn't going to write no more poems like this. I made a mistake.
Evaluating black privilege. Black privilege is the hung elephant swinging in the room, is the memory of a slave ship praying for the Alzheimer's to kick in. Black privilege is me having already memorized my nephew's eulogy, my brother's eulogy, my father's eulogy, my unconceived child's eulogy. Black privilege is me thinking my sister's name safe from that list. Black privilege is me pretending like I know Trayvon Martin on a first name basis. It's me using a dead boy's name to win a poetry slam. It's me carrying a mouthful of other people's skeletons to use at my own convenience. Black privilege is the concrete that holds my breath better than my lungs do. Black privilege is always having to be the strong one. It's having a crowbar for a spine. It's fighting even when you have no more blood to give, even when your bones carried you, even when your mother prayed for you, even after they prepared your body for the funeral. Black privilege is being so unique that not even God will look like you. Black privilege is still being the first person in line to meet him. Black privilege is having to have the same sense of humor as Jesus. Remember how he smiled on the cross? The same way Malcolm X laughed at his bullet, and there I go again, asserting my black privilege, using a dead man's name without his permission. Black privilege is a myth, is a joke, is a punchline, is the time a teacher asked a little boy what he wanted to be when he grew up, and he said alive, is the way she laughed when she said there's no college for that, and it's tiring, you know, for everything about my skin to be a metaphor. For everything black to be pun intended, to be death intended. Black privilege is the applause at the end of this poem. It's me giving you a dead boy's body and you giving me a 10. It's me being okay with that. And I tried writing a love poem the other day, but my fingers wouldn't move. My skin started to blister like it didn't trust me anymore. Like it thought I was trading in this noose for a pearl necklace. Some days I'm afraid to look into the mirror for fear that a bullet George Zimmerman its way into my chest while I was asleep. The breath in my mouth is lucky enough to scare a courtroom. I'll be lucky if I'm alive to make it to the stand. For some people, their trials live longer than they do. Black privilege is knowing that if I die, at least Al Sharpton will come to my funeral. At least Al Sharpton will mason jar my mother's tears, remind us that the only thing we are worthy of is our death. We are judged by the number of people it takes to carry our caskets. Black privilege is me thinking that's enough. It's me thinking this poem is enough. Black privilege is this. Is this breath in my mouth right now? It's me standing right here with a crowd full of witnesses to my heartbeat.
Hello, My name is Nawanda Chambers, co-host of the Black Reality Think Tank. And I was coming to you with a public service announcement about the COVID-19 blues. Has COVID-19 got you down? Are you unsure of what to do to protect yourself? Stressed out because you do not know how to manage the new challenges that COVID-19 has created? Are you experiencing symptoms? Are you afraid? Do you need hope for something else? If you answer yes to any of these questions, contact the crisis line at 1-800-985-5990 or text Talk With Us to 66746. Remember, there is hope, and let's stay safe.
You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
Shem Hotep and greetings, my brothers and sisters. Good evening and welcome to the Black Reality Think Tank. I am your host, William Rogers. We have a very exciting and dynamic conversation for you this evening. As you know, we are here every Tuesday from 7 to 9 p.m. right here at the timeforanawakening.com platform, which is a part of the Black Talk Radio Network platform. We really appreciate you for your patronage and your continued support of what we are trying to do here. We are very proud that the Black Reality Think Tank family has expanded to four other programs that I will talk about later on in our broadcast. But we are so happy that we're here and able to serve you as well. We want to also just mention there are other programs a part of this network. I'll also talk about those a little later on and talk about some of the things that they do as well. Tonight we're going to talk about intellectual racism. And a little bit of how it has impacted our society, and it continues to do so. And obviously, the bottom line is, what are our choices? What have we done to counter this behavior and to sort of put in place and in perspective where this all plays into our struggle and into our liberation? And I have with me tonight my very good and dear brother, out of Durham, North Carolina, Dr. Bruce Bridges. He is going to be joining me very shortly, and we are going to embark upon this discussion. And I'm also happy to bring back another one of our dear friends and participants in our panel conversation, is Brother James Pugh out of Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And so he's here with us as well, too. We're just so happy that all of them, as well as yourself, we're here to join us today and enjoy a dynamic program. So we're going to get started. Before I do, I like to always, as usual, I talk about our ancestors. We stand, as I've said so many times before, we stand on the shoulders of greatness. And so we have to give honor to those who made it possible for us to be where we are today. We have to reach out, call their names into the universe, and thank the Creator for bringing them into our lives. And so at this particular portion of our program, we do that. We ask them to do our libations, ask them to join us. And so at this point, we just want to sort of highlight them. And tonight, we're going to talk about a dear brother, very powerful brother, very brother that is sort of relevant to our subject matter. His African name is MZ Jehuti. M.Z. Jehuti, and his name in his profession was Professor Jacob Carruthers. Professor Jacob Carruthers. He was born on February the 15th, 1930, in Dallas, Texas. He was a firm believer that a large part of liberating African-American people comes from understanding and connecting history, culture, and heritage. He received a B.A. from Samuel Houston College in Austin, Texas, in 1950. He received his Master of Arts from Texas Southern University in 1958, and his Ph.D. in Political Studies from the University of Colorado in 1966. From 1966 to 68, Dr. Carruthers worked as an assistant professor at Kansas State College before joining the staff of Northeastern Illinois University's Center for Inner City Studies. Dr. Carruthers, along with Dr. Anderson Thompson, Robert Starks, Dr. Conrad Worrell, and others, shaped the Inner City Studies program into one that emphasizes self-determination, activism, and study of the global black community. And in this context, Dr. Carruthers earned respect as one of the world's leading experts in classical African civilizations. His interests earned him throughout the continent of Africa, conducting and study tours to Egypt, Ethiopia, the Nile Valley, Zimbabwe, Senegal, the Ivory Coast, and other parts of West Africa. Dr. Carruthers wrote or edited hundreds of essays and papers on his findings, and his major works included The Irritated Genie, an essay on the Haitian Revolution. His essays also included Ancient Egyptian Studies, Intellectual Warfare, The Meta Nuter, The Divine Speech, and Science and Oppression. He lectured at various educational institutions. He served on evaluation teams for many area high schools and worked as a consultant to both the Dayton and Chicago public school systems. Dr. Carruthers served as the founding president of the Association for the Study of Classical African Civilization, better known as ASCAP. And he served there for 5 years. In that capacity, he led a group of 1,000 black teachers, students, artists, and scholars from the United States to the Nubian Cultural Center in Aswan, Egypt, for a 2-week conference and a tour of Nubia and Egypt. He was a founding member, and he was the priest of the Temple of African Community of Chicago and the founding member and director of the Kemetic Institute, which sponsors the annual Teaching About Africa program for school teachers and administrators. He married his wife, Ife, in 1986, and they had 4 children. Dr. Jacob Carruthers passed away on January the 5th, 2004, at the age of 73. Dr. Jacob Carruthers. And so that conversation and that profile is sort of leads us right into what we are here to talk about. Dr. Carruthers wrote a dynamic book called Intellectual Warfare. And tonight we want to take a look at that subject, particularly now, and look at the war that goes on intellectually between the African and the European world. Now, as we all know, in order to wage any type of successful campaign of physical warfare against a nation, the battle must begin with the mind and the intellect. And Europe's physical onslaught of Africa has begun. It did not just begin on a battlefield. It did not begin behind tanks and guns. It began in their universities. It began in their churches. It began in the books that they wrote. It began in their art. It began in their religious artifacts, religious texts, their music, their statues. Many times we will go out to a park to sit down with our family and enjoy a little picnic and feed the pigeons and do whatever. And sitting in front of us is a big, huge statue of Stonewall Jackson. That's teaching you. That is a classroom. That statue represents a classroom of the history of a man that terrorized African people throughout the world. That is intellectual warfare. And so some of the movement that we see today with individuals tearing down those statues and pulling them down, and as we indicated on one of our programs a couple of weeks ago, the title of it was Let Them Fall. They need to all fall. Those are classrooms that have branded us with ideas of the things that our people and our ancestors have gone through, and they no longer need to stand. The Confederate flag branded African people. And I know that there are many of us say, well, you know, let them have it. I don't care. It ain't gonna bother me no more. No, yes, it does. And I think we need to be mindful of that. And so all of those intellectual artifacts that were used to express ideas and to express movements and energies that were part of our captivity and a part of the destruction of African people. And so that war has been gone. They have written textbooks. Educational centers are structured so that we do not learn about ourselves. We learned about the greatness of Christopher Columbus. We learned about the powerful intellectual ability of people like Thomas Jefferson, a pedophile. And we learn about things that are very relevant, not to us, but to another whole different culture. And so tonight we want to talk about that onslaught. And we want to talk about a little bit also exactly how we have responded to that and how we must continue to respond. And we have. We have responded to that movement. We have fought back in a lot of ways. We have created institutions. And we have attempted to wage war intellectually against that type of behavior. Things like the 60s movement where our students wanted to push for African-American studies and studies of Africa and the continent. There were attempts to change the name of departments and courses and create curriculums that were more relevant to us as a people. I was so happy to have spent the last 30 years of my working years at the University of Wisconsin, and when I started there, it was called the Department of African-American Studies. And there was an attempt to change the name to the Department of Africology. And there was a major war that was waged intellectually there on the campus, in the university, of why that should not have that name. And we were victorious. And we ended up not only changing the name, but we were able to get a master's and a PhD program to go along with it. And so there have been some victories. And so Dr. Bridges and I tonight are going to talk about that, and Brother Pugh and the rest of our audience, Brother Timothy out of Philadelphia. We're going to just have a wonderful dialogue and just deal with that. I got my friend Brother Herbie White on the other line. I'm so happy that he's on. And all of you, we're going to give you all a chance to chime in if you desire and give your input, because this is real. This is a real effort, and it is a major part of the captivity of our people. And as I said, it did not begin behind a bullet. It did not begin behind a cannon. It began in a textbook. It began in a classroom. When people gave us books, I was raised in the segregated South. I went to an all-black school. But we read as a literature book, Little Black Sambo. And when we would see the picture of Little Black Sambo, that was branded into our spirit. Now, being kids, we joked around about it and used to tell our friends, "There go your daddy," and we're talking about Little Black Sambo. And it became an area of joke because somehow or the other, deep down in our ancestral spirit, we know that wasn't real, but we had to read it. And we're trying to figure out why he was running a tiger around a tree and had to turn into pancake mix and all that. I didn't see how all that equated with each other. But it was a part of our racist history. It was a part of our racist history to go to the grocery store and pick up a box of pancake mix and see the black woman with a red rag bandana tied around her head, and they would say, "This is the best pancakes alive." Well, what made that the best pancake mix? What made this black man holding a plate with rice on it the best rice to be used? I don't understand that. That's classroom teaching. That's white supremacy being implemented against us. That's intellectual warfare. That's what that is. And that's what we're going to talk about tonight, my brothers and sisters. And we are going to deal with that. We're going to see what now are we doing. I'm very interested in hearing some of the thoughts and ideas that you have. Well, what are we doing now to counter that? How are we dealing with it? One of the most powerful institutions in the black community is the black church. What are we doing to move ourselves toward that, using that institution to build? How much of a role do they play in intellectual racism? Let's discuss all of that tonight. And so with that, I'm going to bring on my dear brother, Brother Bruce Bridges. I got to find you, Brother Bruce. I had silenced a lot of the mics. Just give me a minute. Oh, yeah, here we are. Dr. Bridges, how you doing tonight, my friend?
I'm here. Been here since 8 o'clock, brother.
Okay, good. Well, good. Come on in. And let me just say to our audience before I turn him loose on this, is Dr. Bridges, yeah, right, yeah, I got to turn you loose on it. Dr. Bridges is the perfect example of some of the counter-intellectual racism that we waged against black folk. I mean, waged against the white supremacy system. Dr. Bridges literally had an intellectual bullet that he used to operate. It was a black bookstore called the No Books. And it was just not a bookstore. It was a bookstore of books that you could not find. It was a bookstore that would tell you why you should not call Christianity a white man's religion. It had books in there that talked about why, for instance, that you should not consider yourselves as slaves. And when we talk about the history of our ancestors, there were books in there that talked about the great kings of Nubia, the great kings of the Sudan, the great kings of what was known as sub-Saharan Africa. There were books in there from authors that you could not buy at Barnes & Noble. You could not go over across the street at the HBCU, the Black College, North Carolina Central University, and buy a book about Africa. You had to go to Dr. Bridges' store to get it. The bookstore didn't sell it. That was an intellectual bullet. And it was designed to shoot down white supremacy and white racism. Durham sits in the midst of one of the most powerful corporations in the world, the Ligon & Miles Tobacco Company, part of the Duke University ownership system, and big slave plantation not too far from there that was also a part of our suffering. So I'm going to get on off the soapbox a minute and let Brother Dr. Bridges come on in here and introduce himself and help us talk a little bit about intellectual racism. How you doing, Brother Bridges?
I'm doing fine, Dr. Rogers, and just want to let you know you just about. I heard, like I said, I've been with you since 8 o'clock, and you've did.
That's
a,
right. That's
you've
right.
You've done a great job covering it. You've done a great job covering it, and. It's just a program that we could really have a whole, 12-month seminar every week. You could be discussing this because you hit so many different facets of this whole intellectual warfare topic. You really have.
Right.
And so what I wanted to do, and I figured I'd do this, and then with ample time, I could even go into some other things.
Okay.
But what I want to do first, before I take off on some of the things that you've already mentioned, you said just a little bit about myself being engaged in intellectual warfare. Many years ago, I'm trying to think of who it was, but someone spoke at my store because, as you well know, and some of your listeners probably who know me and who are familiar with the No Book Store know that I brought speakers in from all across the world into my store. And just to call out some of the role, I've had Susan Taylor at my store from Essence Magazine, those who may not know her. I've had Michael Eric Dyson at my store when he was on the faculty at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. I've had Dr. Youssef Ben-Yakinon at my store. I've had Earl Graves at my bookstore, who was the founder and publisher of Black Enterprise Magazine. I've had the rap artist Sister Soldier at my store. I've had the X-rated erotic writer called Zane at my bookstore. I've had Afro-Venezuelans at my store during the time that Hugo Chavez was the president of Venezuela. I've hosted Dr. Ishaka Musa Barashang at my store. I've hosted the entertainer Sun Ra at my store. And the list goes on and on and on. I've had Andrew Young at my bookstore speaking. I've had, long before those in my in your audience have ever heard of him, I've had Umar Johnson at my store, which is another story. I've had him there. I've had another person that you mentioned. I see where he got his name now. You mentioned that Jake Carruthers did an article called The Irritated Genie. And I had the brother from Southeast Washington, D.C., who calls himself the Irritated Genie of Southeast, but he's spoken at my store. So the list goes on and on and on. And I used to have children from the public school system in Durham, North Carolina, from Fayetteville Street School, from Holton Junior High School, from Hillside High School. I've had the drama department there doing some spoken word, and I've had jazz on Friday night with some well-known jazz people. And so you are absolutely right. When you start talking about intellectual warfare, one of the best books that you can, one of the best piece of ammunition that you can have are books. And it came to me as to who made the statement I'm about to make. I didn't make it before because I couldn't think who it was, but it just came to me. Brother Kwame Ture made the statement when he also spoke at my store. He said, the books are weapons, and we need books. Books are weapons.
That's right.
And he was absolutely right. And when we go back into ancient African history, we will find, too, that the best trade to be in the kingdom, society, town, or civilization of Timbuktu was the book business. People were very much into purchasing books and wanted to know, and books would come into the libraries and book vendors and bookstores in Timbuktu from all over the world in West Africa. And this is a part of our history that we have not known. White people have always known that books are weapons, and that when you read a book, you actually add a bullet to your arsenal. Because I couldn't even be on your program tonight not knowing what to say, how to say it, and to refer to anything or to do any kind of critical analysis if I hadn't read some books. Books are weapons, as Kwame said.
Right.
And books are something that we as people need to be familiar with. And nowadays, it doesn't really have to be a book. And I always get upset, Doc, when we talk about books and information, when we look at the fact that there are so many people today who are still very ignorant. And I had come off that word and had stopped using that word, but now I'm getting to the point that things are so serious, you just got to tell it like it is. Our people, brother, are basically an ignorant people. Anytime on this past Saturday and Friday, and people are asking you, as my parents asked me 50, 60 years ago, asked me, and I heard other people saying it to each other, what are you doing for the fourth? We said that years ago before we knew better. But now with the internet, if you don't have a book, my point, there's the internet, the World Wide Web is here. Computer programs are on, like yours, what people can listen to. And people are talking about the 4th of July.
Right.
And if you ask people what is the origin of the celebration of the 4th of July, most of them do not know. They have no knowledge of it. They just do it because that's what we've been miseducated to do. And when I say miseducated, it goes back to another conversation that I had with a good brother friend of mine, and he made the statement. We were talking about miseducation last week, and he said, we haven't really been miseducated. We really have not been educated at all. And you and I talked about it today, and you took it even further. You said we have not been educated on the plantations of America, but when we were in Africa, we were educated to do for ourselves and to do whatever it took for us to build our own communities, our own societies, our own civilizations even, before coming to this country. And that's education. But when you are working and building and making reference to and critically analyzing and doing a synopsis of your slave master's information just to show how intelligent you are, you're really showing how unintelligent you are. You see, so we have to put what education is in its proper place. And since we're talking about intellectual warfare, I like to always go back to, and you brought up the idea of books. I'm going to quote a lot of books tonight, if you don't mind.
That's all right.
I'm going
back
to a book called The History of Word Origins by a man by the name of Shipley. And Shipley, in his book, Dictionary of Word Origins is called, he defines the word education as coming from two Latin words. It comes from the word in the word education, and ducere, D-U-C-A, duca, or ducere, from which it comes from, and that means to lead. And means out of, in the word exit, in the word elevator, or in the word enter, it means to lead out of, to lead out of. And ducere means to lead. Ducere means to lead, and air means out of. So education should lead you out of thinking for someone else or like someone else and lead you into thinking for yourself. As an example, you can train, which is the opposite of education. Training is the opposite of education. We have been a trained people in this country, as Malcolm used to say many years ago. You can train a seal to balance a ball on his nose, and the seal can balance a ball while he's balancing himself on top of the ball. You can train a parrot or a parakeet or a minor bird to say, "Polly want a cracker," and that minor bird or that parrot will repeat, "Polly want a cracker." But that's all it can say. It cannot deviate or cannot go out of that training or that designed realm or that design sphere that it has been put in by the master. And this is where you get the word train that you ride on. And we're going to talk about trains in a few minutes too from another perspective. When you look at a train has an origin and it has a destination. And it's always the same origin and the same destination. You can follow that train because you can track it. And that's why they put trains on tracks, because you can track that train. You can know where it begins, and you can know where that train is going to end. And this is the way we as people have been taught. We have been trained. No one has to tell you that the train is going to start at station so-and-so on 125th Street in New York, or the train is going to start down on some avenue in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And you don't have to say what black people are going to be doing on July the 4th, because you know what they're going to be doing, because that's what they were trained to do. You know what they're going to do on December 25th, because that's what they were trained to do.
Right.
You know what they're going to do on Mother's Day, that has been defined by white America, and Father's Day, which has been defined by white America, and Valentine's Day, which has been defined by white America. You know what they're going to do because they are trained to do that. So in the same way that you know what a train is going to do, you know its origin and you know its destination, you know what black people are trained to do because we have been trained by our slave master to do just that. And the train is like an automaton. An automaton is a mechanized piece of equipment. It's a robot. It's something that can't think for itself. It can only do what it's programmed to do.
Right.
And what do black folk do?
Exactly.
Only what they are programmed to do. Because we are trained to do just that. And we're not going to deviate. But an educated person will begin to say, "Oh, let me think about this. Why am I celebrating the 4th of July?
Right.
And they will begin to ask questions, say, "Let me see where it came from. What is the origin of the 4th of July? Where did it originate? How did it originate? When did it originate?" Bob Marley, in one of his songs called, Buffalo Soldier, he says, "When you know who you are, then you know where you're coming from." Buffalo Soldier,
right.
That's a statement in
right.
Buffalo Soldier. He
right.
says, when you know who you are, you know where you're coming from. So when you understand that 1776 was the year that America became independent from another white nation named Britain, and the Emancipation Proclamation was signed in 1863, And you begin to look at these dates, 1776, they fighting against the British, and you didn't become free, still not free, but didn't even become free on paper until 1863. Then, as the young folks say, you do the math.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know very easily and very clearly that you don't have anything to do with any 4th of July. Mm-hmm. You getting involved in something that, and I'm saying the way I want to say it, too, because I want to mention, too, that it's another thing we've been trained to do, you, me, all of us have, and I have to cringe myself sometimes because I know my training, but we have been trained to say things and to speak and to talk and to walk and to act like and to be sentimental towards everything. We have been made white through in and throughout in every way except the color of our skin. And most of us, if we had a chance and we could, we would want to even change the color of our skin.
We tried.
Most of us would have difficulty doing that. But going back to my point, when we look at it, we see that we involved in something. And like I said, I'm saying it just the way I want to say it. For I don't care who's in your listening. We've been trained to be involved in something that we ain't got nothing to do with. The 4th of July,
right.
Of course, we understand Christmas addicts. We understand the Hessians. Mm-hmm. We understand the brother of Jocko Graves, who held the horses for George Washington as he crossed the Delaware. Mm-hmm. We understand all that. But in all reality, the Declaration of Independence ain't got nothing to do with black folk. We're in Alabama.
Right.
We're in Mississippi. We're in South Carolina.
Right.
We're in the islands of Barbados. We're in Jamaica.
Right.
We're in Trinidad. We're in Cuba on sugar plantations.
Right.
We're chopping cotton in North Carolina and South Carolina and Alabama and Mississippi and Louisiana, Arkansas. That's what we're doing.
Right.
But
now,
when you don't know your history, here you are all up in somebody else's stuff, and you ain't got nothing to do with it. So when people ask you what you're doing on the 4th, say, I'm doing the same thing I did on the 3rd and on the 5th.
Right. Let me interject something right here, Dr. Bridges.
Please, and Dr. Rogers, understand whose program it is, and I know my place.
That's all right.
So anytime,
no.
But you asked me to come on. And
I'm good. I'm good.
Interrupt me at any time.
I'm not worried about that at all.
Okay, good, good.
And you're right about that 4th of July, and the ironic thing about it is that most people who do celebrate it, what they do is they eat food that kills them. I think about my neighbor. I have a couple of neighbors here who were cooking out on 4th of July, and they had them.
Hopefully
big,
not listening to you now, but go ahead.
Big long slabs of ribs and bratwurst and all that stuff that's killing you dead. But anyway, they were enjoying. They called me and said, you want a plate, man? You want a plate? I said, no, let me hold off on that. I'll be all
right. Well, you hold off, huh?
Yeah. But listen, one of the questions I wanted to ask you, which is why it's so important in terms of the intellectual warfare part in your bookstore. As I indicated, your bookstore was, it was a bullet. It was a powerful tool. And as Stokely said, it was a weapon, and you were fighting white supremacy. So I want to be specific so our listeners can kind of get a real understanding of where I'm coming from when asking that question. I recall the times that I've been in your book. A lot of your books were definitely non-traditional, even in reference to African-American history. So I want to ask you, why did you think, for instance, in your bookstore, when you know, and you did the John Henry Clarks, and you did Dr. Akhenaten and Asa Hilliard, and you did all the traditional stuff that you would have in an African-centered study program, but you also had a book in there on Gerald Massey. You had books in there on Art Butchwald.
Right.
Books in there on some of those kinds of thinkers. What was the, and I mean, you know I know because we talked about it, but I want you to tell our audience, why would you have a book in there on Gerald Massey? What has that Gerald Massey got to do with black liberation?
You know, I'm glad you asked that question, and I have to give a tremendous amount of credit to Dr. Early Thorpe, your teacher, my teacher at NCCU, who has gone to the ancestors, who is the chairperson of the history department at NCCU from North Durham, by the way.
Right.
And he said something to me which relates to your question. He came to my store. He said, you know, I wish that I had gotten this material 20 or 30 years ago because I would use it in my classes. I exposed him to some things, Bill, that he had not been exposed to. And as I get to why I had these books, let me tell you what. One thing I have known, and I learned this very early in my travel into studying African history, I learned something that Dr. Arturo Schomburg, we know as Arthur Schomburg,
yep,
founder of and curator of the Schomburg Library Museum slash in Harlem, New York. He made the statement, and Schomburg made the statement after he was a black Puerto Rican, and he went to school, and he went to school one day, and the teacher was talking about the Spanish and the conquest of the Spanish and Spanish history and that kind of thing, which you would get in the classroom in Puerto Rico, just like in the classrooms of the United States of America. We get George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, and we get the poets of Longfellow and Shortfellow and Wordsworth and Wordsworth, and we know all this stuff real good.
Right.
So he got Spanish history. So he asked the teacher, where is some information on the history of my people, meaning black people.
Mm-hmm.
And she said to him that your people have made no contributions to civilization. This is what Schomburg was talking about, Schomburg collection. And he said that after hearing that, he began to go and study. And what Schomburg did, sometimes he was working night jobs that had nothing to do with curating the museum. And he would go and travel around the world, and everything he could find on black people, he would bring it to his little apartment. Eventually outgrew that and then grew into a library. And that is what became the Schomburg collection in New York City.
Right.
And
right.
Schomburg said that, which goes back to your question, I learned this earlier, when you want to study the history of African people, you don't just look into books by writers of African descent or African American descent. You have to look into books by people of all colors and also by people from all over the world and people in all fields of study.
That's
because
right.
There are no disciplines that are taught in the universities of America or in the world that cannot that cannot trace their origins back somewhere into Africa.
That's
because
what I'm talking
all
about.
The fields of study that we have ever been engaged in, and I can call the roll sociology, psychology, history, drama, art, literature, etymology, anatomy, biology, botany, aeronautics, engineering, whatever you want to talk about, it all started with African people down by the base of Mount Kilimanjaro 3.5
right.
to 4 million years ago.
You see, that's,
so
why,
that's
why I asked that question, because you're right. And they knew it.
And
Europe knew that.
There's nothing that you can look at, and you can't. And the truth be told, you will find its origin somewhere on the continent of Africa, or some derivative thereof. As an example, then I know you're trying to get in, but just an example, you asked me about Gerald Massey. Gerald Massey was a white man, and you have to remember that white people have been writing about us before we even started, well, not before, but early on in our history. Before we in America started writing about our history in America, Africans and white people had been writing about us for a long time. Gerald Massey was a British scholar.
Yes.
Gerald Massey wrote a three-volume work. Each volume has two volumes, a three-title work, each title has two volumes. And his first work was called The Natural Genesis. And I quote this in my book, Recapturing the African Mind.
Right.
And it's two volumes, two big, thick volumes. And I bought those books because, like I said, Bill, I was teaching at St. Augustine's College in Raleigh, North Carolina, which I want to get to another bastion of miseducation. And I'll get back to that in a minute. But I bought these books from a place called the Reader's Corner before I even opened the store, a two-volume set, and the man didn't know what he had. But I had learned about Gerald Massey from Dr. Ben. because that's one thing that Ben and Claude did. They always studied, and they understood that you had to go to the Louvre or the museum in Paris. You had to go to museums in London and museums around the world to find some of the history of black people.
That's right. That's
and
right.
So Gerald Massey, that's how I learned about Gerald Massey. And then when you start to look at religion and start looking at people like, disciplines like theosophy or the philosophy of theology, the philosophy, I repeat, of theology, then you got to look at people like Annie Besant. You got to look at people Madam H.P. Blavatsky, who wrote a two-volume set called The Secret Doctrine, which I recall you bought from me because I told you what they were and why they were important.
Right.
And one thing about you, you were a good student. Whenever I suggested something to you, most times you would go ahead and buy it.
That's right.
So
that's
I mentioned
right.
that. And also, in my travels, I used to go to Los Angeles, California, and I met a man. I didn't meet a man, but yeah, I met a man by the name of Dr. Ligon, and he had an organization called the Aquarius Research Society, and he also was into studying ancient African civilization, but even more so, he was studying the civilizations of the Chinese and the Druids in Europe. He was studying the Japanese and studying Oriental. That's what I want.
That's what it was called.
He was studying
Oriental
philosophy.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And anything Oriental is black. Oriental means East.
Right.
Occident means West. So anything Oriental means something that comes out of the mind and the head of the black man.
That's right.
It may not be the black man in Africa, but it could be the black Buddha in India.
That's right.
It could be the black Chinese who were the originators of China. Before these yellow Chinese that we see today.
Right.
Because when you go into all those islands, the Fiji Islands, the Fuji Islands, Tahiti, and all those islands of the Pacific, you find that they were inhabited by people of color.
And see,
my search began.
And that's the point. That's the point I wanted to make. Because, you see, and what I want our audience to understand is when we talk about intellectual warfare, yeah, it wasn't necessarily always because of the fact that we just didn't publicize our history well, but there were deliberate attacks to sort of suppress those things that were written by us and those things that were done by us. And just like Dr. Bridges was talking about the Oriental, when there was a curator out of the University of Chicago whose name was James Breasted. Breasted had gone to Africa and collected all kinds of stuff about African history. And he wanted to come back to America and put a museum called the Egyptian Museum, the Egyptian Display, but he had to get it funded. And he went to Andrew Carnegie, who was the one that funded all of those libraries and museums, and asked him for money. And he told him that he wanted to start an African museum. He said, well, you're not going to start that with my money. He said, now, if you can come up with another name, I might give it to you. And he came up with the Oriental Museum. And so to this day in Chicago, the Oriental Museum still stands to that history. That's a history that...
I need two...
And somebody needs to mute them.
I muted them. There was a brother calling from Newman. He might be someone you had told to call. He's out of Newman.
I did. I knew where he was at the restaurant. I heard I want two Big Macs and a fry.
But
go ahead.
But we'll come back to him. So anyway, that was deliberately done. So the African History Museum went up, but it went up as the Oriental Museum and not the African Museum. So that's what I was trying to get our people.
And that's an excellent point that you make, and you really lead me real good now, because I was going to mention Andrew Carnegie, because it was people like Andrew Carnegie, Russell Sage, J.P. Morgan, and Leland Stanford, from which we get Stanford University out in Palo Alto, California.
Right.
These were the money people whose names will be in Forbes magazine now, 500 richest men, not 500, but billionaires in the world. These were the kinds of people who funded these programs on black college campuses. And so by the same token that Carnegie was not going to fund anything about black folk at the University of Chicago, these men also did not fund anything at black colleges. We thought they were funding some good things, but it had to be a curriculum that had been designed and that they had approved before they were going to fund anything at black colleges. Give you an example. Stanford, J.P. Morgan, and Carnegie, and Russell Sage, all of them made their money in the railroad industry in the United States of America. During the time that there was a gold rush in California, they went there, and they were even called robber barons. They were barons, but they were robbers because they had unscrupulous means of making money.
That's right.
And these racist, slaveholding rich people like Phelps Stokes and the Fulbright scholarship that were given to us, these are the people who funded black education.
That's right.
There's a good, and since you mentioned Chicago, there's a brother who wrote a book, he's now deceased, I just learned, from the University of Chicago, wrote a book, The White Architects of Black Education.
Oh, yeah.
And so and these programs were funded by white folk.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why we had to teach what they wanted us to teach, because they were the money behind our education. And that's why, and that's really why we messed up now. We are messed up today as a people. We really are messed up as a people. And I used to hold back on it, but now it's time to just let it all hang out.
Yeah. Dr. Bridges, before you go on, I just want to let our audience know you're listening to the Black Reality Think Tank. We are here with Dr. Bruce Bridges. We are talking about intellectual warfare and how it's been waged against us. I want to just make a note also that we are broadcasting from our studios here in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and we are now in the process of a very bad electrical and a thunderstorm. But so far it has not interfered with us, but sometimes because we are internet, storms like that have a tendency to knock us off. So prayerfully, I hope that it won't. I want to get through this. Dr. Bridges, I'm going to take a break and then I'm going to come back. How are you? We got a bunch of folks on the line, and I'll bring on Brother Pugh. Let him have a few things, and then we can come back and kind of finish up some of the things that you're saying. Is that okay with you?
That's fine with me. As a matter of fact, I want to go back and talk about how this whole intellectual racism actually started.
Well, when I come back, we'll do that. We'll have you open up with that. I'll have you start with that, and then we'll go to our audience and let's open up to see if any of our brothers and sisters got questions or comments about any of the things we take. But let's take a little quick break, and we'll come right back.
This world is such a, and when I say this world, I mean it. I don't mean in an ideal sense. I mean in every day, every little thing you do. It's such a, gimme, gimme, gimme. Everybody back off. You know, everybody's like, you taught that from school, everywhere. Big business, you want to be successful, you want to be like Trump, gimme, gimme, gimme. Push, 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 push. Step, step, step. Crush, crush, crush. That's how it all is. And it's like, nobody ever stopped. Just, you know, I feel like, instead of us just being like, slavery's bad, slavery's there. Bad whitey, bad whitey. I mean, all right, let's stop that. And everybody's smart enough to know that, I mean, we've been slighted, and we want ours. And I don't mean by, like, ours, 40 acres and a mule, because we passed that. But we need help. I mean, for us to be on our own 2 feet, us meaning youth or us meaning black people, whatever you want to take it from, for us to be on our own 2 feet, we do need help. Because we have been here. We have been a good friend. If you want to make it a relationship type thing, we have been there, and now we deserve our payback. It's like, you got a friend that you don't never look out for. You know, you dressed up in jewels. Now America's got jewels, and they paid and everything, and they lending money to everybody except us. And it's like, you know, everybody need a little help on their way to being, you know, self-reliant. You know what I'm saying? That's the whole thing about the album, about the Special Olympics. Everybody need a little something and they to be independent. No independent person just grew up and was born independent. You worked and you learned teamwork, and you learn cooperation and unity and struggle, and then you became independent. And we have to teach that and instill that. And why is it that they want to do that? I mean, if this is truly a melting pot in the country where we care about, and Lady Liberty got a hand like this, she really loves us, then we really need to be like that. And it needs to be the black kids. If there's a white person who got money, then you need to help them. He need to help black kids, Mexican kids, Korean kids, whatever. But it needs to be real. And it needs to be before we all die, and then you say, oh, I made a mistake. We should have gave them some money. We really should have helped these folks. It's going to be too late. You know what I'm saying? And then that's when you got to pay your own karma. And that's when God make you punish. When God punishes you. Because I feel like, you know, It's too much money here. I mean, nobody should be hitting Lotto for $36 million and we got people starving in the streets. That is not idealistic. That's just real. That is just stupid. There's no way Michael Jackson should have, or whoever Jackson, should have $1,000,000,000 and then there's people starving. There's no way. There's no way that these people should own planes and their people don't have houses, apartments, shacks, drawers, pants. If they earned it, then I think that that's good, and I think that they deserve it. But even if you earned it, you still owe. Because look at me, I don't have that mega money, but I feel guilty walking by somebody. I got to give them some mail. And if I know I got $3,000 in my pocket, I feel like it's wrong to give that person a quarter or a dollar. It's wrong. Only you know what you got in your pocket. And that's wrong. No matter what they do, if they take it and drink it, they take it and drink it. But, I mean, you got it. You understand it? We all know how hard it is, and it's not about if you good or you bad. So since it's not about if you good or you bad, we know that because he don't got, don't mean he was bad. Or don't mean he's a criminal, or don't mean he's crazy, or a drug addict, or none of that. It just means he don't got. And ain't it bad that you got 30, I mean, can you imagine somebody having $32 million? $32 million, and this person has nothing, and you can sleep? You can still go to the movies about, I mean, and then these are the type of people that get humanitarian awards. Millionaires. How can they be humanitarians by the fact that they're millionaires and there's so many poor people shows how unhumane they are. You know what I'm saying? And that bugs me. Not saying that when I'm never going to be rich and I'm there, you know what I'm saying? But I'm saying it's a struggle and I think everybody deserves it. And I think there's a way to pay these people. I think there is a way. It just takes to be revolutionary. And it takes to do something out of the ordinary. You know what I'm saying? Like, I think that if we just said, okay, I got an idea. No more porno buildings. You know what I'm saying? Let's build houses. Or no more polo games. Let's build houses for poor people. You know what I'm saying? Or, look, okay, I know you're rich. I know you got $40 billion. But can you just keep it to one house? You only need one house. And if you only got two kids, can you just keep it to two rooms? I mean, why have 52 rooms and you know there's somebody with no room? It just don't make sense to me. It don't. And then these people celebrate Christmas. They got big trees, huge trees, all the little trimmings. Everybody got gifts and then somebody's starving. And they're having a white Christmas. They're having a great Christmas. Eggnog and the whole nine. That's not fair to them.
Birds flying high, you know how I feel. Sun in the sky, you know how I feel. Breeze drifting on by, you know how I feel. It's a new dawn, it's a new day. It's a new life for me, yeah. It's a new dawn, it's a new day. For me, ooh, and I'm feeling good. Fish in the sea, you know how I feel. River running free. It's a new day, it's a new life for me, and I'm feeling good. Dragonfly out in the sun, you know what I mean, don't you know? Butterflies all having fun, you know what I mean? Sleep in peace when day is done, that's what I mean. And this old world is a new world and a bold world for me. Stars, when you shine, you know how I feel. Send out the pine. Freedom is mine, and I know how I feel.
You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
Shem Hotep, my brothers and sisters, we are back. I'm your host, William Rogers. We thank Brother Tupac Shakur and Sister Nina Simone for that middle break, a timeout for us. We thank you. We just want to kind of mention that our program is a call-in format. Our phone number here is 215, area code 490-9832. So for those of you who are listening via the Internet and would like to call and ask a question or join us in the conversation, you can do so by calling again to area code 215-490-9832. The Black Reality Think Tank broadcasts four times a week. We have four different programs. We have our Tuesday program that you're listening to now, 7 to 9 Central Time, each and every Tuesday. We have another program that airs on Thursday evening from 6 to 8. It is a group of millennial young women who talk about their community, their jobs, their children, their relationships, and our people. And the name of their program is After 7. And they come on each Thursday evening from 6 to 8 p.m., and they are part of the Black Reality Think Tank Network. And then on Saturday from 3 to 5, we have another group that is our weekend edition of the Black Reality Think Tank. We have a group of psychotherapists who both have clinics and programs, and they are talking about stress in families and children and men and women. And they are looking to make a contribution in that light that help us to weave through some of the different things that we go and the traumatization of our life sometimes here, and what the Honorable Elijah Muhammad said here in North America. So be sure to listen to them every Saturday from 3 to 5 here. This is our weekend edition. And then again at 6 o'clock on Saturday from 6 to 8, we have Brother Alfonso Watkins, and he has a program called the Sankofa Elders Council. And his program discusses various issues of our community, and he sort of looks at speaking through the eyes of our ancestors. And there's a dynamic program. Excuse me just a second. And it was very dynamic and very engaging. So these are our four programs. We are on the TimeForAnAwakening.com platform, which is a part of the Black Talk Radio Network platform, who also has programs. We have a program on Friday that is very dynamic from 8 to 10 Eastern Time. They broadcast out of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. It's called Time for an Awakening, and it's a part of this wonderful discussion format with Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. And from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And that's every Friday from 8 to 10. And they're on again on Sunday from 7 to 10 with their same format. They have dynamic guests. They have interviewed so many very powerful people. We encourage you to do that. And then on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, we have a brother out of Atlanta, Georgia. Brother Oshiemi Adelabu has a program called African Perspectives. And he broadcasts every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 11 to 1 Eastern Time. 11 to 1 Eastern Time. So that is the lineup that we have here. We appreciate all of you for being on with us today. We're talking to Dr. Bruce Bridges, who is no stranger to the Black Reality Think Tank. He's been with us many, many times. Appreciate him so much. We are talking about intellectual warfare, kind of giving you an idea of how it works. We are looking at the advantages that we have used in intellectual warfare, as well as what the Euro world has used against us in intellectual warfare. And so our program here, as you know, is to make you aware and to keep things available so that you can... and to keep things available so that you will be able to understand, and as we teach our children and as we try to create agendas for our community that will bring about change. And so we are a think tank format. We already bring ideas to the table. We're not just talking heads. We're looking for solutions, and hopefully that we can do that. So, again, thank you so much. Dr. Bridges, you wanted to pick up on
Yeah, I would, but if you want to go to your callers first, because no. This is it's fine with me, and I can come back and get it in then.
Okay, all right, good. One of the people that are always good, I appreciate him so much and love him to death. He has always been a very major contributor to our program here, and he always has such provocative thoughts and ideas, and that's Brother James Pugh. He's calling us from Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and so he's back with us now. I'm just going to bring him on for a few minutes and see what he needs to say. Good afternoon, Brother Pugh.
Yes, good evening, Doctor.
Good afternoon.
Good evening, Dr. Bridges.
All right, Dr. Pugh, how are you doing tonight?
Pretty good. Didn't know I was a doctor though, but thanks for the compliment.
I just put it on you, and I want to hope that I said something to your liking when I was talking.
Oh yes, you did quite a bit. Even though ultimately I do have to ask you a question, and as an educator, I think you might appreciate that. You said that we are messed up as a people, and if we looked at that as a curriculum problem. I was just kind of wondering what would be four objectives that you would have to straighten out what our problem is. But let me get my little lick in before I have you answer that and just give you my overall impression of this moment. The only thing I would have to say is that the Black National Anthem is Lift Every Voice and Sing. And I think that that's where we are today, is that everyone has an opportunity to speak. And whereas when Arthur Schomburg, teacher, told him that, black people hadn't made any history and whatnot,
right.
that kind of statement would be accepted without any rebuttal, certainly from anybody white. Today, that wouldn't, because today that would be immediately identified as white supremacist. And mm-hmm. So the key distinction that we have in 2020 that we didn't have, say, in 2019 or in 1950 and so on, is that white supremacy and all this stuff was in the dark. It was, people like Jacob Carruthers or John Henry Clark might be able to say some stuff that would put together the sort of systematic effort to marginalize black people. But most of the people in the world didn't accept that. They would think that it's just history being taught, and that the reason black people aren't in there is because black people ain't got no history. But nowadays, everybody knows that. But now the next dimension, in other words, it's one thing to know that the books are incomplete, and then the next part is completing the books and so on. And I think that's where we're at today. And what I meant by Lift Every Voice and Sing is that the difference that we have today that we didn't have in the past is that there are people willing to listen to us today. And there are even black people willing to listen to other black people today that who wouldn't have been 10 years ago or 20 years ago.
Good point. As a matter of fact, that leads me into the answer that you, to the question you asked me, and that is in the educational arena, in the elementary school, junior high schools, and also in the colleges and universities, with what's going on today, as you said, black people are beginning to question and want to see this history rewritten and want a whole new agenda from teachers as they come into the classroom. So you're absolutely right, and that's what has to be done to answer the question as to some things that can be done and what really has to be done. And because people now are becoming aware, and it's something one night I'd like to recite.
Let me just enter this little tight point. Where we are today is the equivalent of the South African students in Soweto who, the day that the students refused to be taught Afrikaans, insisted upon being taught in their own language. That's where things are today, that people recognize that the stories we've been told are completely bogus, and now they're interested in, well, what's the real story? But go ahead.
That's an excellent point. And, since you mentioned it, too, and when they did that, they did it when they became aware. So whenever people become aware, then they begin to stand up and do something about situations. And then, of course, there are some who, when they do become aware, they still can't break out of the old traditional way of teaching and way of thinking and looking at situations in the world. They're still going to hold on to it no matter how many facts and figures and how much information you show them. They still want to hold on to the old way. But you're right. Once they begin in South Africa, they demanded it. And not only that, but since you mentioned South Africa, let's go down to Jamaica. In Jamaica, Africans on the island of Jamaica are demanding now that they use patois, which is the Jamaican tongue, not Jamaican tongue, but it's a twist that Jamaicans have on the English language. In the they're demanding that in the classrooms, in Creole, in Haiti, and all those kinds of things. We're beginning to see things that Europeans have said are inferior and are nothing and have no substance. We're beginning to see that they do have substance, that we'll begin to challenge the system so these things can become a part of the system. And that's how, going back to what I said about Dr. Rogers, he came up with so many things. Going back to what he said about the Black Studies movement, the Black Studies movement in the 60s, Nathan Hare and several other people, he's at the University of San Francisco, by the way, he's not there now, but he is still living. Nathan Hare and others began to push for Black Studies when they became aware. So it's the time, as you said, James, it's the time. It's the time, and people are beginning to see it, and they can exert themselves. If not, as Martin Luther King said, if not now, when?
Right. I love it. I love it.
Oh, and one other thing is that we've got a situation where white people are demanding to know what the real story is.
You know what? And that's another good point. You keep hitting on things that I can take up on, and that the white people, they even begin to build about black books and want to know what they want to read the ISIS papers.
That's true. That's true.
Yeah,
that's really true.
Yeah, they want to know what's going on. People are becoming, everybody in the whole world, due to this thing that happened with George Floyd and all the things that happened many years ago that led up to this. All of this is a part of Emmett Till and the four people down in the little girls and Dexter Avenue Baptist. All of that is causing this to happen. It's coming to fruition, and everybody wants to know now.
Yeah.
White people, black people, everybody's beginning to see America for its hypocrisy and the lies that she has taught the whole world for all these years.
Right.
And not just America, but when we say America, we're talking about her extensions. We're talking about Britain and France and Portugal and Spain and Germany and all these nations, white nations of the earth, have taught the world a whole lie. And that's it. So I think you might want to hear from some callers, Bill, if you want to.
And finally, there's one other dimension, you know, in terms of strategic advantage that we have in the intellectual warfare going on in 2020, is that what we have today is equivalent to World War II having an enemy like Hitler, which was unambiguously evil to anybody in the world. And as a result, it was a basis for a rallying point of people in the world. Well, right now, we have a poster.
Everybody can see his evil.
Right. Right now, we have a poster boy for white supremacy the evils of white supremacy. Everybody in the world recognizes Donald Trump as a white supremacist, and anything he's associated with is associated with white supremacy.
Right.
Just before I came on, I was reading an article in the Atlantic Monthly, and it was about fashion. And it was about the whole idea that ultimately the fundamental ideal of fashion is to advance white supremacist ideas. Well, even fashion now is being challenged. In other words, people are beginning to resist it as something that elevates, you know, whiteness and wealth and denigrates. And by the way, I didn't catch the name of that fellow who said you can't possibly be a humanitarian and be a millionaire when there are people that have nothing. Who was the fellow, Dr. Rogers? I'd love to know more about him.
That was Tupac Shakur.
That was
Tupac,
okay. Right.
Oh, that certainly doesn't sound like him to me.
Yeah, that's Tupac. That was Tupac Shakur.
Oh, and speaking of that, by the way, someone had told me that what's his name, the boxer, Anthony Joshua. That he was quoting Tupac Shakur on a protest line in London, George Floyd thing.
Tupac was a deep brother, young brother. He really was.
You know, there's serious work being done by In other words, our intellectuals ain't just coming out of books.
No, they're not.
They're not just coming out of universities.
That's
they're coming
right.
from all over the place.
All
and
over
I
the
think
place.
That,
that's right.
You know, this is a real.
It is. It is.
Well, thank you so much, Brother Pugh. I appreciate
that.
We'll come back to you in a few minutes. I wanted to. One of the things, just real quickly, a little sidebar piece. At some point in time, I'd like to get some folks on from the EFA community and some of those spiritualists, and maybe Brother Dr. Maxwell, Dr. Bridges, and let them explain from a spiritual realm how this George Floyd thing was sort of a resurrection of our ancestors. There's a lot of deepness to this that is just beyond what we have heard and seen. This man is almost surfaced like a god coming to wake up the dry bones. And so anyway, maybe we'll get Reverend Maxwell on here and get somebody out of the EFAR community, let them come on and talk about the spirituality part of that. Okay, let me go over here to a caller that Dr. Bridges might know him. Brother White, you know this other guy over here on the phone that I'm talking to, the other guy here on the mic, you know him? You ever heard of him? Dr. Bridges, you know him?
Good evening, Dr. Clark. I'm Dr. Rogers, Brother Bridges.
Okay.
And everybody on the show.
I like the fact you called me Dr. Clark. I'm real honored. But you know this other guy I got sitting over here with me?
Oh, yes, I definitely do.
Okay. All right.
Definitely.
All right. What you got to say tonight about all of this?
Black people are suffering from African cultural malnutrition. You know, anytime you don't get the things that your body needs when you're eating, you eat the wrong things, they make you sick.
Mm.
So when you get the wrong information in your mind, it makes your mind sick. All this European information that we get makes your mind sick. And at certain points, you start to act irrationally. And you try to find your way to make yourself healthy and happy, you resort to alcohol and drugs, promiscuity that destroys you. If you don't get what you need.
Sure.
I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, and I went to school. I lived on Fulton Street. I walked down the street to school named after Europeans.
Right.
I went to a school, junior high school 35, Stephen Decatur, named after a European. I went to class, and there was pictures on the wall of Washington, Jefferson, all those kind of people. And then the day started off with the Pledge of Allegiance and the National Anthem. After 3 years of school,
really?
My mind was on life support.
That's exactly right.
You know? And so I'm walking around looking for all the wrong things, trying to make myself. I know I'm not supposed to be feeling like this. But I don't know why I'm feeling like this.
Mm-hmm.
And so by the time you get to the no bookstore, it might be too late. You know, it's like cancer.
Right.
If you don't catch it in its early stages, there's nothing you can do about it.
So you're saying, in a way, we might work in a hopeless cause, huh?
Right. Right.
What I'm saying is, I'm just saying what's wrong and what we need. We got to get to our children's minds long before they go to the university and get a black studies program.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
By that time, it might be too late.
Both you and Dr. Bridges, there's something I want you to recall. You all would appreciate this, and there's several other callers on from 919. I remember.
We might have to do a part two on this one. Go ahead, Doc.
Yeah, no. I remember coming from Hillside on the bus. Sometimes I didn't ride the school bus. I would get on the city bus. And I remember when we would hit Main Street and the bus was going down towards Five Points, we would pass the county courthouse. And I remember everybody would get over on that side to look out the window to see if they knew anybody up there in the jails upstairs, you know, because the jail faced right out to the street.
And y'all did that?
Oh, yeah, big time. That was a real big thing, ride by there. And then, you know, like, you know, being kids, you know, you know, they would kid around with each other. I bet your daddy up there and stuff like that, you know, and people would, you know, say stuff, things like that. But anyway, I remember that statue that sat right in front of that window of the county courthouse, and where you could look upstairs. And when you look up to see, you also saw that statue. And I used to always wonder what that statue was, you know. But as just as Brother White said, I was being branded in the mind. You got black men upstairs in that room up there, the jail that was in the Durham County Courthouse. And the statue down there, so we were being double whammy about things. And it was amazing, because that was during the years of the Recorder's Court. And I don't know how many of you remember that, Recorder's Court. George Wilson used to give all the black folk all these 30 days and all that kind of stuff for just public drunken and all that kind of stuff.
Judge Wilson, yeah, Judge Wilson.
Yeah, but anyway.
If you roll down a little further, you could see that white fire escape on the side of the Carolina Theater.
Yep. That's right. That's exactly right. So anyway, you're right what you're saying. We were branded with those images, things like that, branded. Dr. Bridges, you got a group of folk from Chapel Hill. Did you want to open
that's
up
why
to them?
I'm quiet for a minute, because sometimes they say, y'all don't ever get to the callers. They tell me, say, I listen, but y'all don't get to the callers, so I'm quiet.
All right, I'm going to open up to some of the Chapel Hill brothers and sisters. As a matter of fact, if you are from Chapel Hill, I will open all of the mics, and you'll get a chance to speak. If any of the brothers or sisters who are on from Chapel Hill, 919-360-919-929, if there's anything you'd like to say, your microphone is open. Okay. I guess they don't want to say anything right now. Appreciate you listening anyway. Thank you so much for your call in. Got another 919. I don't have a number, but I do have a name. Last name is Fuller. Brother Fuller, would you wish to say something? Okay. Nope, I guess he's just listening too as well. That's all right, that's fine. Newbern, North Carolina, 252474. Would you like to say something, caller? 252474. Okay, all right, you're listening again. Let's go here, 919-985, Raleigh, North Carolina. Would you like to say something, Carl? 919-985. Okay, all right.
Sound like they're listening, huh?
Yeah, they just listen. That's good. I appreciate it. We appreciate that. Let me go to my brother, Brother Timothy from Philadelphia. Brother Timothy, I know you got something.
Let me tell you something. I've listened to all my professors, you know, because I feel like I'm in a classroom. I heard Professor Pugh. I heard Dr. Bridges. I hear you, Dr. Rogers, Brother White. I feel so good. But you know what? I'm so happy. I was born in 1961.
Okay.
I'm going to tell you. Because when I was in elementary school, teachers who taught me went to Cheney and went to undergraduates down south. I was so fortunate. And by the time I got to high school, my advisor and teacher, John Skeef, who came up with a school, Owambe Institute. Listen to that name, Owambe Institute, was my advisor and teacher.
What year was this? What year would they call it, the Owambe?
I came out of high school in 79.
Okay, and they were... Okay.
Exactly.
All right.
And listen to this. Those schools... Well, in walking distance, except for the elementary school I went to, I had to catch the bus when I was in the fourth, fifth, and sixth grade. And it was an integrated school, but the teachers graduated from HBCUs. I'm serious about that. And even though there were literature that we read that was white, those teachers taught us black people, Frederick Douglass and Booker T. Washington. I'm making this up. So by the time I got to high school, my advising teacher went to Cheney with my aunt. He said, your last name is Hannah? He said, are you related to Ola and Joyce Hannah? He said, I went to school with your aunt. And it was great. So at that point, I knew I was supposed to go to Cheney at first, but my mom said, change your mind about that because accreditation is shaky there. I said, I understand it. She made sure I was going to HBCU, and I chose Lincoln. That's another story here. Let me get to this. I'm going to say this to you. When I was in high school, and I had to do papers, you know, Paul Robeson, I told you, died in the house, which is two blocks away from my house. When I had to do book reports, guess where I went to do my book reports? Hawking's Bookstore.
Okay.
Hawking's Bookstore was such a treasure in our community that when my aunt was pregnant with my cousin Hawking, my uncle, who's now dead, Billy 41X, he said, I was all in that bookstore so much to him, he named his son Hawking. That's interesting. So I got to go and say this now, because Dr. Bridges, bringing all this out, is very good, is what you're saying.
Right.
Because after Hawking died, his daughter took over the store, okay? And I got my first Quran there. I got all of J. A. Rogers' books there. Anything we ever needed. It was one bookstore to go to in Philadelphia, in West Philly, and that was Hawking's Bookstore.
Right.
Now, his daughter is trying her best to keep it because they had a Bob Black, and all of us still go by there because she still has some stuff, but she's kind of locked in time. She needs to serve coffee and food. We did in the nation very young. The thing was to go to Hawking's Bookstore,
mm-hmm.
and to go to 11th and Spring Garden to a place called Patterson's Vegetarian Restaurant because they had Worthington products. See, I'm talking about eating, right. How to eat to live. And the message said, the reason why we fear the devil is because he told us how to eat the wrong foods. So we're eating right about that time.
Right.
Okay? And Patterson's was announced in the final call in the Muhammad speech.
Okay.
And then after that, later on, in the 80s, Natural Food Eating was that Broad and the Locust. A guy by the name of Brahim did all the cooking. He was no dairy products. It was all vegetarian. Now, I'm going to bring it back now because the 85 is coming. Hawking's dead. The daughter's doing the best she can. Still there. They did a store called Know Thyself Bookstore, which was between Cedar and Larchwood. Now, two brothers had it.
Okay.
Deacon Dell and he is still living, and Dell is dead, and we called him the war correspondent. He said what you said. So on weapons, we call him the war correspondent. Okay. Now, I'm saying to you that brothers and sisters like me who were in neighborhoods where we called 52nd Street the Golden Strip because we had our own restaurants, we had our own cleaners, we had our own tailor shop, everything was ours. Okay, now that Pakistan people and Asians who are serving you breakfast. Oh my God! But so you say to yourself, what happened to that strip? And the people who grew up with me, unfortunately, it didn't get taken out by the pipe. You would say to, at one time while I was working on my book, Bush in '68, the Jacksons influenced me. Those same people I grew up with. You want to know where the conscience went. As this Bush went, so did the conscience.
Right, right.
So you can't say that it wasn't around them.
Right.
Okay. And what Jennifer Tyson did, okay, but you can say that by the time I was born in 61, it was more there for us than it is for you and what happened to our generation.
Right.
My uncle said, Jim, you always talk about these children. He said, but your generation raised them. So that's another issue right there.
Okay.
But listen to me.
Okay.
All the 107 books that the messenger read, Jill Massey and Godfrey Henry were both of them because the messenger told us he gave us all, he told the truth about black people.
That's true.
You're exactly right.
Right. And
you are. Wait a minute. Hold on.
Brother Sam.
Yes, I'm listening.
Okay.
I'm listening.
Yeah, Brother Tim, I was about to say, too, because Brother William may want to go to another call, but what I was going to tell you is Sister Clara Muhammad's Kitchen, I hope that's still in Philadelphia. And since you mentioned going back to my store, I used to have Dale Jones at my store, too. He was a good friend of mine. Just want to mention that. Wrote the book Culture Bandits. And also, when I started my store, I visited Hakeem's to get some ideas.
Right.
Okay,
right.
And so I'm just tuning in on Philly. And one reason that the Philadelphia community was well protected and you had so much stuff going on in the community, even though they were doing some other things, there were brothers like Sam Christian and brothers like Bo Baines who were around there. But anyway, we can talk about that later, Brother Tim. All right.
Right, right. And very clearly, that's one of the reasons that I read Dr. Jake Carruthers, because, you know, Dr. Carruthers was operating in a community and an environment that was wide open for African studies, and not only just from the inner city group and the Kemetic Institute, there were other things in Chicago that was doing that as well. Haki Mahabudi's bookstore, Third World Press, that was actually in the
right,
business
Chicago,
of,
right.
of printing. I don't know if that's a real no, the fact I can't trace it down, but anyway, we were trying our best to, embrace the Mahabudi's bookstore. I used to go over there every Saturday, pick up that he had used books, and he used to sell the Black Scholar magazine for 25 cents, used copies of Black Scholar magazine and things like that. And that's a community encouraging intellectual growth, and that's a very powerful thing. Okay, let me go to Brother Marcus out of Phoenix. Brother Marcus, any comments?
Yes, Dr. Rogers.
Thank you, sir.
And good evening to your guest.
Good evening.
Brother. You know, the same curriculum that teaches white folks to hate black people teaches black people to hate black people. So, you know, years ago in the 90s, there was a push for a curriculum of inclusion. We're mm-hmm. talking about, oh, let's include our, you know, let's be included. But you got to ask yourself, really, do you really want to be included in it's like if you have a glass of cyanide and you pour out half the glass of cyanide and fill it up with juices and vitamins and all this nutrition, it's still poison. So you can't include our history in with their history. We have to get a curriculum of exclusion. That's what we really need. And we have the tools at our disposal now to do it as a people. We get a curriculum of exclusion, excluding all the lies they have told us, and get it into the hands of our people. You're not going to get it into the schools, you know that. You ain't going to put it in his school because he's going to make sure you destroy anything. So we get our own curriculum, find a way to get it to our people on the continent, in Africa, everywhere in America right here, and get the information out to our people. We got to forget about him.
Right.
Not stop trying to be included in his thing because
right. Right.
all lies.
Right. All right. Thank you so much, brother. Really appreciate you. Sister Yan, Greensboro, you want to say something or are you just listening?
I was going to listen, but I'm just going to say something very quickly that I moved to say. Brother Mark, first of all, good evening, my brothers.
Good afternoon. Good evening to you. Good evening.
Hotep.
Oh, Tap, Brother Bruce, you know I got a bone to pick with you all the time, right?
Okay, that's fine. Why don't you give me a call tomorrow? It's a good day for me.
Okay. But I love you all, and I missed most of the phone call, so I don't want to make any comments because I didn't hear, you know, most of the content.
Right.
But what Brother Marcus said, that's the bottom line. That's the bottom line for me. No matter what we see going on around us, the bottom line is that we have to do just what Brother Marcus said. And Bruce, Dr. Bridges, you said something a while back, and it was so powerful. You said that black people need to quarantine ourselves and get our own stuff together. and that has stuck with me ever since. That was.
And I'm glad you reminded me, because I had really forgotten I said that, and that's true, though. That's true.
So it's on point. It's on point. And the last thing I want to say, so thank you for that, Brother Drew. And the last thing I want to say is that I've been listening to Black Men Talk about black manhood and the importance of black manhood. Mm-hmm. And it's to counter all of this homosexual, LGBT, XYZ thing that's going on. And it's been a beautiful thing to hear. And when I've heard those conversations, I heard what I'm hearing right now, a brotherhood of men who love each other. To counter the nonsense that's constantly pushed at us. I've been hearing black men express love and brotherhood in ways that just make me so, it just feels so good from head to toe. Right. So I just want to again say thank you, brothers, and I love you.
Right.
All right.
That's beautiful. Okay. Thank you so much. You know, and I don't think
that's the first female caller you had tonight, too, isn't it? First female caller that you had.
Yeah, that's right, so far, yeah. And you know, Sister Yan, that's a real powerful statement you made, because I know that there's no single incident sometimes that makes things happen. It's a collection of activities and viewpoints. But I really
your recording has reached the maximum length. To replay your message, press.
And I think that it has a lot to do with, you know, the Million Man March encouraged a lot of that brotherhood stuff. And I think that that's something that I think we would have to read. But again, I'm not singling that out as the only source, but I think very clearly that that may have had something to do with it. And that's a good point you raised. I'm glad you brought that up too. Okay, let me go. I know there's one other caller here that I wanted to give an opportunity. I wasn't sure that they want to say something, but I know that they are here. 477-919-477. Sister, how you doing tonight? Do you want to say something? You just listening?
Just listening.
All right. Thank you so much. Thank you so much. Okay. Well, Dr. Bridges, we've got about less than 15 minutes. You want to talk about some things?
Yeah, I just it's so much that we have talked about. And one thing I was hoping Sister Yan would mention, but she didn't go there with it when she talked about the brothers. One thing that I like is the incident that occurred down in Stone Mountain, Georgia, when the brothers came out in black and all ready to take care of business if necessary, and how they said they were standing up for the black nation. Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah. Matter of fact, Brother Oshie talked about that on his radio program. I think it was Monday. Very deep.
I missed him talking about it. What did he say about it? Pretty much that they were there in force. And
right, and I think he played a clipping from one of the brothers that organized that march.
And like I said, Sister Ayan made me think about it, because it does make you feel good when black men begin to stand up, because that's what it's definitely going to take. So to see that, and not necessarily coming from any religious organization or any fraternity or sorority, just black, I mean, not sorority, but, you know, black men, fraternity, but just black, no particular club, just black men standing up and who are focused on whatever the situation is that needs to be taken care of. And the fact that black men stood up like that, I really felt good about that. And really what we're doing here, Bill, is the same thing that we saw back during the 60s. Everything's happening now. Like you're talking about, somebody mentioned something about the curriculum. Same thing that was happening with black studies in the 60s at Kent State University, at San Francisco State University, all over the country. People were wanting black studies. That's happening now. People want to know things. Same thing with the brothers standing up in Stone Mountain, Georgia. That was the Black Panther Party then. There was Stokely Carmichael. That was H. Rapp Brown. So the same thing. We're reliving the same thing, but this time, it has a feel of longevity. For some reason, it has a feel of longevity, and I hope that is the case, and it really doesn't die down. And I think that we as people have to do whatever it is that we can do to keep it going. And I'm going to ask you a question here for a minute, because I respect your answers to certain things, and maybe our listeners can gather something from you and me just talking to each other now. What do you say, and I'm asking for a particular reason, which I won't go into now, but what would you say to somebody who's saying, well, all y'all doing is talking on the air and things have not really changed and that kind of thing? What do you do for those naysayers and people who make comments like that?
That's a good point. Well, first of all...
And another good point just before you answer, too, and I won't say who it is right now, but there are people that you know who are very much against what's going on in the streets of America now.
People that you know personally
who are very much against what's going on. So what do you say to people like that who's against what they see young people doing and against the statues coming down and against, you know, everything positive happening? What would you say to people?
Well, anytime, I would say, first of all, that anytime you have encountered a people that have gone for over 400 years of intense racism at a level in which the African world has done so, there are multiple things that has to be done. Everybody has to be a part. It's like James Pugh said. He said in what Langston Hughes said about, you know, singing the national about the national anthem. All voices must be heard. And everybody doesn't sing tenor. Everybody doesn't sing alto. Everybody doesn't sing soprano. In other words, meaning that everybody doesn't have the same weight. But it works. Mm-hmm. Martin Luther King had his weight. Reverend Jackson had his weight. The SCLC had their weight.
Reverend Lowry.
They had their weight. But it all works for the good of the common bound. And that's what we have to pay attention to. So, no, we're not on the street right now. But what we're doing is we're bringing people together and let them share ideas that can possibly motivate, generate, and uplift somebody to go out and do some things on their own. So we gotta stop that. You know, we do that a lot, man. We really do. If everybody ain't do what I do, they ain't doing nothing. You know, you can't look at it like that. That's just not the way to do that. And that's a mistake that we make, and particularly coming from, as I said, the kind of oppression that we came under. And the kind of stress that we carry. So if I'm on the streets marching with my picket signs and you're at home writing letters to the newspapers, you know, and doing some of the things, or you in a room teaching a bunch of other students coming behind to do that, that all is working for the common bound. You know, and that's the way you got to look at it. Everybody wasn't the same.
And you know, that's a good point, Bill. I'm glad, and I'm saying that because there are people who thinking like what I asked, the question I asked, and who say some of the kinds of things that I asked you about. And I asked you that because sometimes they can get you down and say, "Well, damn, I'm trying to help you and trying to wake you up, and you don't see it. You don't even take it as being anything of any substance or anything that's really helping you."
Right.
So that's why I'm glad you addressed that, because there are people like that who don't recognize the importance of what it is we're doing. It reminds me of back in the movement days, Dr. King would always give credit to the sisters whose house he would go to when you couldn't go to the restaurants in Alabama.
Sure did.
Who were cooking the food, who were making the sweet potato pie,
right,
and who were frying the chicken.
Right.
And then he would give credit to these sisters, and he gave credit to the Staple Singers, who may not have been marching, but who sang songs like "Respect Yourself,"
right,
and songs like "When Will We Be Paid?" And he gave credit to Curtis Mayfield when Curtis said, "Keep on pushing."
Right,
and James light is spade and whiter.
And James Brown may have sung about hot pants. But he also said, "I'm black and I'm proud." Say it loud.
that's right. So
don't knock him because he said about the hot pants.
Whatever we is, on whatever level or in whatever position we are and can make a contribution, if we're on a job and can help a black person on the job get a promotion or support them in some way, whatever we're doing and wherever we are, we really need to support each other, I think.
All right. Let me see if this person might want to say something. Area code 919. 641, are you just a listening caller? Would you like to say something in this conversation? 919-641, are you interested in saying something? Are you just listening? Okay, I wasn't sure. So you're just listening? That's good. I thank you so much for doing that, for joining. I was trying to grab some of the folks, Dr. Bridges, that might be, I know you...
Yeah, had, go ahead. Yeah, you know, I always like to hear from the callers, right?
Yeah, but you had asked a group of people. 919, I would ask that one. So, okay, all right, well, you can go back. Like I said, I was just trying to grab some of the callers that might have something to say that may have done so.
Have you got a 919-656 on the line?
656? Nope. I don't see it.
Okay.
I had asked Brother Griffin, did he want to say something, but he didn't respond yet. Brother Griffin, did you want to say something? Brother Griffin, did you want to say something?
Okay. Everybody's listening tonight, aren't they?
That's good. We need that as well. So like I said, just like we were talking about, some people want to talk, some people want to listen. You know, it's all to the value of what we're trying to
and
do.
And I don't know what our topic is for next week, but I really want to go into this whole development of racism in the academy or in the universities and how it started with Blumenbach and Arthur Gobineau and some of those people. I think we might find very interesting, but if not next week, maybe sometime. But
yeah,
I really have enjoyed.
Next week, Sister Ayan is going to lead us in a discussion on areas involving where some of our people are still continuing the process of being violent against each other. And
that's a good one. As a matter of fact, I'm glad you said that because as I think I was talking to somebody earlier today, and they were saying that these brothers who are in these gangs, if they had a knowledge of themselves and knew their history and their culture and what they were before coming here, they wouldn't be turning guns on each other and terrorizing their own neighborhoods if they just knew themselves. So what we're saying, I think, is right on time because when people, Don Brother Elijah Muhammad used to teach that the Nation of Islam had lessons that people would have to study and learn. And one of the questions was, what is the definition of a savage? And a savage is, as he defined it, is a person who has lost the knowledge of himself and is acting like a fool. That's a savage.
Yeah, yeah.
And so you see many of our people who conduct themselves in such a way, which is what Sister Anand is going to talk about next week, gangs and black-on-black violence, they just have no knowledge of themselves, Bill, knowledge of themselves at all.
I agree 100%. So I'm going to let you go on and close this out, Brother Bridges. We got about 3 minutes, 2 minutes and a half. Any final thoughts you want to leave our audience?
Yeah, I'd just like to maybe say that we have to begin to control our own thinking. When you find a people whose thinking is controlled by other people, then those other people who control those people's thinking are going to continue to be slaves to the ones who make the definitions.
That's powerful. Well, Dr. Bridges, I really appreciate you. Thank you so much. You answered my clarion call today when I asked you to come on and talk a little bit about this, and I thought about it in relationship to the no books.
That's the way we have to be. You know, you called me at the last minute, but you needed me, and I answered. And that's
sure
the way
did.
It should be
that's
with
right.
brothers, brothers to brothers. If I need something, I got a brother I can call and need some help, no matter where it is, what time it is, then the brother needs to get up and do it. If I'm called the same way, we need to support each other that way. So you
that's
told
good.
Me, you said, I need you tonight. And I said, okay, what you need me to do, I'm ready to do it. So that's the kind of, that's the way it should go in the black community. And that's why I said, the brothers down on Stone Mountain, Power to the people, and
right.
Black Lives Matter.
Thank you so much. God bless all of you. I'll see you next Tuesday right here at 7 p.m. Central Time, and we'll have another very dynamic conversation.
Get our best trained, best educated, best equipped, best prepared troops refuse to fight. Matter of fact, it's safe to say that they would rather switch than fight. Come on, get down.
touch. I'm the hardest to start a work of art to revolutionize, make a change.